Chapter 4. Venice. Shamron eased his body wearily onto a church pew, and, with a liver-spotted hand, motioned for Gabriel to adjust the angle of the fluorescent lights. From a metal briefcase, he removed a manila envelope, and from the envelope, three photographs. He placed the first wordlessly into Gabriel's outstretched hand. Gabriel looked down and saw himself walking in the Campo di Ghetto Nuovo with Chiara at his side. He examined the image calmly, as if it was a painting in need of restoration, and tried to determine when it had been taken. Their clothing, the sharp contrast of the afternoon light, and the dead leaves on the paving stones of the square suggested late autumn. Shamron held up a second photo. Gabriel and Chiara again, this time in a restaurant not far from their house in Cannareggio. The third photograph, Gabriel leaving the church of San Giovanni Crisostomo, turned his spinal cord to ice. How many times, he wondered, how many times had an assassin been waiting in the Campo when he left work for the night?
It couldn't last forever, Shamron said. Eventually they were going to find you here. You have made too many enemies over the years. We both have.
Gabriel handed the photographs back to Shamron. Chiara sat down next to him. In this setting, in this light, she reminded Gabriel of Raphael's Alba Madonna. Her hair, dark and curly, and shimmering with highlights of chestnut and auburn, was clasped at the nape of her neck and spilled riotously about her shoulders. Her skin was olive and luminous, her eyes deep brown with flecks of gold shone in the lamplight. They tended to change color with her mood. Gabriel, in Chiara's dark gaze, could see there was more bad news to come. Shamron reached into the briefcase a second time.
This is a dossier summarizing your career. Uncomfortably accurate, I'm afraid.
He paused.
Seeing one's entire life reduced to a succession of deaths can be difficult. Are you sure you want to read it?
Gabriel held out his hand. Shamron had not bothered to have the dossier translated from Arabic into Hebrew. The Jezreel Valley contained many Arab towns and villages. Gabriel's Arabic, while not fluent, was good enough to read a recitation of his own professional exploits. Shamron was right. Somehow, his enemies had managed to assemble a tellingly complete account of his career. The dossier referred to Gabriel by his real name. The date of his recruitment was correct, as was the reason, though it credited him with killing 8 members of Black September, when in truth he had killed only 6. Several pages were devoted to Gabriel's assassination of Khalil el-Wazir, the PLO's second-in-command, better known by his nom de guerre, Abu Jihad. Gabriel had killed him inside his seaside villa in Tunis in 1988. The description of the operation had been provided by Abu Jihad's wife, Jihad, who had been present that night. The entry for Vienna was terse and noteworthy for its one glaring factual error. Wife and son killed by car bomb, Vienna, January 1991. Reprisal ordered by Abu Ammar. Abu Ammar was none other than Yasser Arafat. Gabriel had always suspected Arafat's personal involvement. Until now, he had never seen evidence confirming it. He held up the pages of the dossier.
Where did you get this?
Milan, Shamron said.
He then told Gabriel about the raid on the pensione and the computer disk found in one of the suspect's bags.
When the Italians couldn't break the security code, they turned to us. I suppose we should consider ourselves fortunate. If they'd been able to get inside that disk, they would have been able to solve a 30-year-old Roman murder in a matter of minutes.
Contained in the dossier was the fact that he had killed a Black September operative named Wadal Abdel Zwaiter in a Rome apartment house in 1972. It was that killing, Gabriel's first, which had caused his temples to gray virtually overnight. He handed the dossier back to Shamron.
What do we know about the men who were hiding in that pensione?
based on fingerprints discovered on the material and in the room, along with the photos in the false passports, we've managed to identify one of them. His name is Daoud Hadawi, a Palestinian, born in the Jenin refugee camp. He was a ringleader during the First Intifada, and was in and out of prison. At 17, he joined Fatah, and when Arafat came to Gaza after Oslo, Hadawi went to work for Al-Am Al-Raisa, the Presidential Security Service. You may know that organization by its previous name, the name it used before Oslo, Force 17, Arafat's Praetorian Guard, Arafat's favorite killers.
What else do we know about Hadawi?
Shamron reached into his coat pocket for his cigarettes. Gabriel stopped him and explained that the smoke was harmful to the paintings. Shamron sighed and carried on with his briefing. We were convinced he was involved in terror operations during the Second Intifada. We placed him on a list of wanted suspects, but the Palestinian Authority refused to hand him over. We assumed he was hiding inside the Mukata with Arafat and the rest of the senior men. The Mukata was the name of Arafat's walled, militarized compound in Ramallah. But when we smashed into the Mukata during Operation Defense Shield, Hadawi was not among the men we found hiding there.
Where was he?
Shabak and Aman assumed he'd fled to Jordan or Lebanon. They turned the case file over to the office. Unfortunately, locating Hadawi was not high on Lev's list of priorities. It turned out to be a very costly mistake.
Is Hadawi still a member of Force 17?
Unclear.
Does he still have links to Arafat?
We simply don't know yet.
Does Shabak think Hadawi was capable of pulling off something like this?
Not really. He was considered a foot soldier, not a mastermind. Rome was planned and executed by a class act, someone very smart, someone capable of pulling off a shocking act of terrorism on the world stage, someone with experience in this sort of thing.
Like who?
That's what we want you to find out.
Me?
We want you to find the animals who carried out this massacre, and we want you to put them down. It will be just like 72, except this time you'll be the one in command instead of me. Gabriel shook his head slowly.
I'm not an investigator. I was the executioner. Besides, this isn't my war any longer. It's Shabak's war. It's the Sayaret's war.
They've come back to Europe, Shamron said. Europe is office turf. This is your war.
Why don't you lead the team?
I'm a mere advisor with no operational authority. Shamron's tone was heavy with irony. He enjoyed playing the role of the downtrodden civil servant who'd been put out to pasture before his time, even if the reality was far different. Besides, Lev wouldn't hear of it.
And he would let me lead the team?
He doesn't have a choice. The Prime Minister has already spoken on the matter. Of course, I was whispering in his ear at the time. Shamron paused. Lev did make one demand, however, and I'm afraid I was in no position to challenge it.
What's that?
He insists that you come back on the payroll and return to full-time duty. Gabriel had left the office after the bombing in Vienna. His missions, in the intervening years, had been essentially freelance affairs orchestrated by Shamron.
He wants me under office discipline so he can keep me under his control, Gabriel said.
His motives are rather transparent. For a man of the secret world, Lev does a terrible job covering his own tracks. But don't take it personally. It's me who Lev despises. You, I'm afraid, are guilty by association. A sudden clamor rose from the street, children running and shouting. Shamron remained silent until the noise dissipated. When he spoke again, his voice took on a new tone of gravity. That disc contains more than just your dossier, he said. We also found surveillance photographs and detailed security analysis of several potential future targets in Europe.
What sort of targets?
Embassies, consulates, LL offices, major synagogues, Jewish community centers, schools. Shamron's final word echoed in the apses of the church for a moment before dying away.
They're going to hit us again, Gabriel. You can help us stop them. You know them as well as anyone at King Saul Boulevard.
He turned his gaze toward the altarpiece.
You know them like the brush strokes of that Bellini.
Shamron looked at Gabriel.
Your days in Venice are over. There's a plane waiting on the other side of the lagoon. You're getting on it, whether you like it or not. What you do after that is your business. You can sit around a safe flat, pondering the state of your life, or you can help us find these murderers before they strike again.
Gabriel could muster no challenge. Shamron was right. He had no choice but to leave. Still, there was something in the self-satisfied tone of Shamron's voice that Gabriel found irritating. Shamron had been pleading with him for years to forsake Europe and return to Israel, preferably to assume control of the office, or at least operations. Gabriel couldn't help but feel Shamron, in his Machiavellian way, was deriving a certain satisfaction from the situation. He stood and walked to the altarpiece. Attempting to hurriedly finish it was out of the question. The figure of Saint Christopher, with the Christ child straddling his shoulders, still required substantial inpainting. Then the entire piece required a new coat of varnish, 4 weeks minimum, probably more like six. He supposed Tiepolo would have to give it to someone else to finish, a thought that made Gabriel's stomach churn with acid. But there was something else. Israel wasn't exactly flooded with Italian old master paintings. Chances were he would never again touch a Bellini.
My work is here, Gabriel said, though his voice was heavy with resignation.
No, your work was here. You're coming home.
Shamron hesitated.
To King Saul Boulevard. To Eretz Yisrael.
Leah too, Gabriel said. It's going to take some time to make the arrangements. Until then, I want a man at the hospital. I don't care if the dossier says she's dead.
I've already dispatched a security agent from London Station.
Gabriel looked at Chiara.
She's coming too, Shamron said, reading his thoughts. We'll leave a team from security in Venice as long as necessary to look after her family and the community.
I have to tell Tiepolo that I'm leaving.
The fewer people who know, the better.
I don't care, said Gabriel. I owe it to him.
Do what you need to do. Just do it quickly.
What about the house? There are things.
Extraction will see to your things. By the time they finish, there'll be no trace of you here.
Shamron, in spite of Gabriel's admonition against smoking, lit a cigarette. He held the match aloft for a moment, then ceremoniously blew it out.
It will be as though you never existed.
Shamron granted him 1 hour. Gabriel, with Chiara's Beretta in his pocket, slipped from the back door of the church and made his way to Castello. He had lived there during his apprenticeship, and knew the tangled streets of the Sestieri well. He walked in a section where tourists never went, and many of the houses were uninhabited. His route, deliberately circuitous, took him through several underground sotterporteghi, where it was impossible for a pursuer to hide. Once, he purposely led himself into an enclosed corte, from which there was only one way to enter and leave. After 20 minutes, he was certain no one was following him. Francesco Tiepolo kept his office in San Marco, on the Viale 22 Marzo. Gabriel found him seated behind the large oaken table he used as his desk, his large body folded over a stack of paperwork. Were it not for the notebook computer and electric light, he might have been a figure in a Renaissance painting. He looked up at Gabriel and smiled through his tangled black beard. On the streets of Venice, tourists often mistook him for Luciano Pavarotti. Lately, he'd taken to posing for photographs, and singing a few lines of Non ti scordar di me very badly. He had been a great restorer once. Now he was a businessman. Indeed, Tiepolo's was the most successful restoration firm in the entire Veneto. He spent most of his day preparing bids for various projects or locked in political battles with Venetian officials charged with the care of the city's artistic and architectural treasures. Once a day, he popped into the church of San Crisostomo to prod his gifted chief restorer, the recalcitrant and reclusive Mario Del Vecchio, into working faster. Tiepolo was the only person in the art world other than Julian Isherwood who knew the truth about the talented Signore Del Vecchio. Tiepolo suggested they walk around the corner for a glass of Prosecco. Then, confronted with Gabriel's reluctance to leave the office, he fetched a bottle of Ripasso from the next room instead. Gabriel scanned the framed photographs arrayed on the wall behind the Venetian's desk. There was a new photograph of Tiepolo with his good friend, His Holiness Pope Paul VII. Pietro Lucchesi had been the Patriarch of Venice before reluctantly moving to the Vatican to become leader of the world's 1 billion Roman Catholics. The photo showed Tiepolo and the Pope seated in the dining room of Tiepolo's gloriously restored palazzo overlooking the Grand Canal. What it didn't show was that Gabriel, at that moment, had been seated to the Pope's left. 2 years earlier, with a bit of help from Tiepolo, he had saved the Pope's life and destroyed a grave threat to his papacy. He hoped that Chiara and the team from Extraction had found the Hanukkah card the Holy Father had sent him in December. Tiepolo poured out 2 glasses of the blood-red Ripasso and slid one across the tabletop toward Gabriel. Half of his own wine disappeared in one swallow. Only in his work was Tiepolo meticulous. In all other things, food, drink, his many women, Francesco Tiepolo was prone to extravagance and excess. Gabriel leaned forward and quietly told Tiepolo the news, that his enemies had found him in Venice, that he had no choice but to leave the city immediately, before he could finish the Bellini. Tiepolo smiled sadly and closed his eyes.
"Is there no other way?"
Gabriel shook his head.
"They know where I live. They know where I work. And Chiara?"
Gabriel answered the question truthfully. Tiepolo, in Italian, was an uomo di fiducia, a man of trust.
"I'm sorry about the Bellini," Gabriel said. "I should have finished it months ago."
He would have, were it not for the Radek affair.
"To hell with the Bellini! It's you I care about!"
Tiepolo stared into his wine.
"I'm going to miss Mario Del Vecchio, but I'm going to miss Gabriel Alon more."
Gabriel raised his glass in Tiepolo's direction.
"I know I'm not in any position to ask for a favor."
His voice trailed off. Tiepolo looked at the photograph of the Holy Father and said,
"You saved my friend's life. What do you want?" "Finish the Bellini for me."
"Me?"
"We shared the same teacher, Francesco. Umberto Conte taught you well."
"Yes, but do you know how long it's been since I've put a brush to a painting?"
"You'll do just fine. Trust me."
"That's quite a vote of confidence coming from a man like Mario Del Vecchio."
"Mario's dead, Francesco. Mario never was."
Gabriel made his way back to Canareggio through the gathering darkness. He took a short detour so he could walk one final time through the ancient ghetto. In the square, he watched proprietarily as a pair of boys clad all in black, with wispy, untrimmed beards, hurried across the paving stones toward the yeshiva. He looked at his watch. An hour had elapsed since he'd left Shamron and Chiara in the church. He turned and started walking toward the house that would soon bear no trace of him, and the plane that would carry him home again. As he walked, 2 questions ran ceaselessly in his mind. Who had found him in Venice? And why was he being allowed to leave alive? Chapter 5. Tel Aviv, March 10th.
Gabriel arrived at Kingsall Boulevard at 8 o'clock the following morning. Two officers from personnel were waiting for him. They wore matching cotton shirts and matching smiles, the tight, humorless smiles of men who are empowered to ask embarrassing questions. In the eyes of personnel, Gabriel's return to discipline was long overdue. He was like fine wine, to be savored slowly and with much commentary. He placed himself in their hands with the melancholy air of a fugitive surrendering after a long time on the run, and followed them upstairs. There were declarations to sign, oaths to swear, and unapologetic questions about the state of his bank account. He was photographed and issued an identification badge, which was hung like an albatross around his neck. New fingerprints were taken, because no one could seem to find the originals from 1972. He was examined by a medical doctor who, upon seeing the scars all over his body, seemed surprised to find a pulse in his wrist and blood pressure in his veins. He even endured a mind-numbing session with an office psychologist, who jotted a few notes in Gabriel's file and hurriedly fled the room. Motor pool granted him temporary use of a Skoda sedan. Housekeeping assigned him a windowless cell in the basement and living accommodations until he could find a place of his own. Gabriel, who wished to maintain a buffer between himself and Kingsall Boulevard, chose a disused safe flat on Narkis Street in Jerusalem, not far from the old campus of the Bezalel Academy of Art. At sunset, he was summoned to the executive suite for the final ritual of his return. The light above Lev's door shone green. His secretary, an attractive girl with suntanned legs and hair the color of cinnamon, pressed an unseen button, and the door swung silently open under its own power, like the entrance of a bank vault. Gabriel stepped inside and paused before advancing farther. He felt a peculiar sense of dislocation, like a man who returns to his childhood bedroom, only to find it turned into his father's den. The office had been Shamron's once. Gone were the scarred wooden desk and steel file cabinets, and the German shortwave radio on which he had monitored the bellicose voices of his enemies. Now the motif was modern and monochrome gray. The old linoleum floor had been torn up and covered by a plush executive rug. Strategically placed around the room were several expensive-looking oriental carpets. From high in the ceiling, a recessed halogen bulb shone down upon a seating area of contemporary black leather furniture that reminded Gabriel of a first-class airport lounge. The wall nearest the seating area had been transformed into a giant plasma video display from which the world's media flickered silently in high definition. The remote control, resting on the glass coffee table, was the size of a prayer book and looked as though it required an advanced engineering degree to operate. Whereas Shamron had placed his desk barrier-like in front of the door, Lev had chosen to reside near the windows. The pale gray blinds were drawn, but angled in such a way that it was just possible to make out the ragged skyline of downtown Tel Aviv and a large orange sun sinking slowly into the Mediterranean. Lev's desk, a large expanse of smoky glass, was vacant except for a computer and a pair of telephones. He was seated before the monitor, with his hands folded, praying mantis-like beneath his defiant chin. His bald head glowed softly in the restrained light. Gabriel noted that Lev's eyeglasses cast no reflection. He wore special lenses so that his enemies, meaning anyone within the office who opposed him, could not see what he was reading. "Gabriel," he said, as though surprised by his presence. He came out from behind the desk and shook Gabriel's hand carefully, then, with a bony finger pressed to Gabriel's spine like a pistol, guided him across the room to the seating area. As he was lowering himself into a chair, one of the images on the video wall caught his attention. Which one, Gabriel could not tell. He sighed heavily, then turned his head slowly and studied Gabriel with a predatory gaze. The shadow of their last meeting fell between them. It had taken place not in this room, but in Jerusalem, in the office of the Prime Minister. There had been but one item on the agenda: whether the office should capture Eric Radek and bring him back to Israel to face justice. Lev had steadfastly opposed the idea, despite the fact that Radek had very nearly killed Gabriel's mother during the death march from Auschwitz in January 1945. The Prime Minister had overruled Lev and mandated that Gabriel be placed in charge of the operation to seize Radek and spirit him out of Austria. Radek now resided in a police detention facility in Jaffa, and Lev had spent much of the last 2 months trying to undo the damage caused by his initial opposition to Radek's capture. Lev's standing among the troops at King Saul Boulevard had fallen to dangerously low levels. In Jerusalem, some were beginning to wonder whether Lev's time had come and gone.
"I've taken the liberty of assembling your team," said Lev.
He pressed the intercom button on the telephone and summoned his secretary. She entered the room with a batch of files in her arms. Lev's meetings were always well choreographed. He adored nothing more than standing before a complicated chart, pointer in hand, and decoding its secrets for a mystified audience. As the secretary headed toward the door, Lev looked at Gabriel to see if he was watching her walk away. Then he handed the files wordlessly to Gabriel and turned his gaze once more toward the video wall. Gabriel lifted the cover and found several sheets of paper, each containing the thumbnail sketch of a team member. Name, section, area of expertise. The sun had slipped below the horizon, and the office had grown very dark. Gabriel, in order to read the file, had to lean slightly to his left and hold the pages directly beneath the halogen ceiling lamp. After a few moments, he looked up at Lev.
"You forgot to add representatives from Hadassah and the Maccabi Youth Sports League."
Gabriel's irony bounced off Lev like a stone thrown at a speeding freight train.
"Your point, Gabriel?"
"It's too big. We'll be tripping over each other."
It occurred to Gabriel that perhaps Lev wanted precisely that.
"I can carry out the investigation with half these people."
Lev, with a languid wave of his long hand, invited Gabriel to reduce the size of the team. Gabriel began removing pages and placing them on the coffee table. Lev frowned. Gabriel's cuts, while random, had clearly dislodged Lev's informant.
"This will do,"
Gabriel said, handing the personnel files back to Lev.
"We'll need a place to meet. My office is too small."
"Housekeeping has set aside room 456C.
Gabriel knew it well. Three levels below ground, 456C was nothing more than a dumping ground for old furniture and obsolete computer equipment, often used by members of the night staff as a spot for romantic trysts.
"Fine,"
said Gabriel. Lev crossed one long leg over the other and picked a piece of invisible lint from his trousers.
"You've never worked at headquarters before, have you, Gabriel?"
"You know exactly where I've worked."
"Which is why I feel I should give you a helpful reminder. The progress of your investigation, assuming you make any, is not to be shared with anyone outside this service. You will report to me, and only me. Is that clear?"
"I take it you're referring to the old man?"
"You know exactly who I'm referring to."
"Shamron and I are personal friends. I won't cut off my relationship with him just to put your mind at ease."
"But you will refrain from discussing the case with him. Have I made myself clear?"
Lev had neither mud on his boots nor blood on his hands, but he was a master in the art of boardroom thrust and parry.
"Yes, Lev," Gabriel said. "I know exactly where you stand."
Lev got to his feet, signaling that the meeting had ended, but Gabriel remained seated.
"There's something else I needed to discuss with you."
"My time is limited," said Lev, looking down.
"It won't take but a minute. It's about Kiara."
Lev, rather than suffer the indignity of retaking his seat, walked over to the window and looked down at the lights of Tel Aviv.
"What about her?"
I don't want her used again until we determine who else saw the contents of that computer disk.
Lev rotated slowly, as if he were a statue on a pedestal. With the light behind him, he appeared as nothing more than a dark mass against the horizontal lines of the blinds.
I'm glad you feel comfortable enough to walk into this office and make demands, he said acidly. But Kiara's future will be determined by operations, and, ultimately, by me.
She is only a Botlevia. Are you telling me you can't find any other girls to serve as escort officers?
She's got an Italian passport, and she's damned good at her job. You know that better than anyone.
She's also burned, Lev. If you put her in the field with an agent, you'll put the agent at risk. I wouldn't work with her.
Fortunately, most of our field officers aren't as arrogant as you.
I never knew a good field man who wasn't arrogant, Lev.
A silence fell between them. Lev walked over to his desk and pressed a button on his telephone. The door swung open automatically, and a wedge of bright light entered from Lev's reception area.
It's been my experience that field agents don't take well to the discipline of headquarters. In the field, they're a law unto themselves. But in here, I'm the law.
I'll try to keep that in mind, Sheriff.
Don't fuck this up, Lev said as Gabriel headed toward the open door. If you do, not even Shamron will be able to protect you.
They convened at 9 o'clock the following morning. Housekeeping had made a half-hearted attempt at putting the room in order. A chipped wooden conference table stood in the center, surrounded by several mismatched chairs. The excess debris had been piled against the far wall. Gabriel, as he entered, was reminded of the pews stacked against the wall of the Church of San Giovanni Crisostomo. Everything about the setting suggested impermanence, including the misleading paper sign affixed to the door with packing tape that read, Temporary Committee for the Study of Terror Threats in Western Europe. Gabriel embraced the disarray. From adversity, Shamron always said, comes cohesion. His team numbered 4 in all, 2 boys and 2 girls, all eager and adoring and unbearably young. From research came Yossi, a pedantic but brilliant intelligence analyst who had read greats at Oxford. From history, a dark-eyed girl named Dina, who could recite the time, place, and butcher's bill of every act of terrorism ever committed against the State of Israel. She walked with a very slight limp, and was treated with unfailing tenderness by the others. Gabriel found the reason why in her personnel file. Dina had been standing in Tel Aviv's Dizengoff Street the day in October 1994 when a Hamas suicide bomber turned the number 5 bus into a coffin for 21 people. Her mother and 2 of her sisters were killed that day. Dina had been seriously wounded. The 2 other members of the team came from outside the office. The Arab Affairs Department of Shabak lent Gabriel a pockmarked tough named Yaakov, who had spent the better part of the last decade trying to penetrate the Palestinian Authority's apparatus of terror. Military intelligence gave him a captain named Ramona, who was Shamron's niece. The last time Gabriel had seen Ramona, she'd been tearing fearlessly down Shamron's steep driveway on a kick scooter. These days, Ramona could usually be found in a secure aircraft hangar north of Tel Aviv, poring over the papers seized from Yasser Arafat's compound in Ramallah. Instinctively, Gabriel approached the case as though it was a painting. He was reminded of a restoration he had performed not long after his apprenticeship, a crucifixion by an early Renaissance Venetian named Conegliano. Gabriel, after removing the yellowed varnish, had discovered that virtually nothing remained of the original. He had then spent the next 3 months piecing together filaments of the obscure painter's life and work. When finally he began the retouching, it was as if Conegliano was standing at his shoulder, guiding his hand. The artist, in this case,
was the one member of the terrorist team who had been positively identified, Daoud Hadawi. Hadawi was their porthole onto the operation, and slowly, over the next several days, his brief life began to take shape on the walls of Gabriel's lair. It ran from a ramshackle refugee camp in Jenin, through the stones and burning tires of the First Intifada, and into the ranks of Force 17. No corner of Hadawi's life remained unexplored. His schooling and his religious fervor, his family and his clan, his associations and his influences. Known Force 17 personnel were located and accounted for. Those thought to possess the skills or education necessary to build the bomb that leveled the Rome embassy were singled out for special attention. Arab informants were called in and questioned from Ramallah to Gaza City, from Rome to London. Communications intercepts, stretching 2 years into the past, were filtered through the computers and sifted for any reference to a large-scale operation in Europe. Old surveillance and watch reports were re-examined, old airline passenger lists scoured again. Ramona returned to her hangar each morning to search for traces of Rome in the captured files of Arafat's intelligence services. Gradually, room 456C began to resemble the command bunker of a besieged army. There were so many photographs pinned to the walls, it seemed their search was being monitored by an Arab mob. The girls from the data rooms took to leaving their deliveries outside in the corridor. Gabriel requisitioned the room next door, along with cots and bedding. He also requested an easel and a chalkboard. Yossi contemptuously pointed out that no one had seen a chalkboard inside King Saul Boulevard in 20 years. And for his impertinence, he was ordered to find one. It came the next morning. "I had to call in a lot of favors," said Yossi. "The stone tablets and carving tools arrive next week." Gabriel began each day by posing the same series of questions. Who built the bomb? Who conceived and planned the attack? Who directed the teams? Who secured the safe houses and the transport? Who handled the money? Who was the mastermind? Was there a state sponsor in Damascus or Tehran or Tripoli? A week into the investigation, none of the questions had been answered. Frustration began to set in. Gabriel instructed them to change their approach. "Sometimes these puzzles are solved by the piece you discover, and sometimes they're solved by finding the piece that's missing." He stood before his chalkboard and wiped it until it was a blank slate. "Start looking for the piece that's missing." They ate supper together each night as a family. Gabriel encouraged them to set aside the case and to talk about something else. He naturally became the focus of their curiosity, for they had studied his exploits at the academy and even read about some of them in their history books at school. He was reticent at first, but they coaxed him from his shell, and he played the role that Shamron, on countless other occasions, had played before him. He told them about Black September and Abu Jihad, his foray into the heart of the Vatican, and his capture of Eric Radek. Ramona drew him out on the role Restoration had played in his cover and the maintenance of his sanity. Yossi started to ask about the bombing in Vienna, but Dina, scholar of terror and counter-terror, placed a restraining hand on Yossi's arm and adroitly changed the subject. Sometimes, when Gabriel was speaking, he would see Dina gazing at him as though he were a hero's monument come to life. He realized that he, like Shamron before him, had crossed the line between mortal and myth. Radek intrigued them the most. Gabriel understood the reason for this all too well. They lived in a country where it was not safe to eat in a restaurant or to ride a bus, yet it was the Holocaust that occupied a special place in their nightmares. "Is it true you made him walk through Treblinka? Did you touch him? How could you stand the sound of his voice in that place? Were you ever tempted to take matters into your own hands?" Yaakov wanted to know only one thing. "Was he sorry he murdered our grandmothers?"
and Gabriel, though he was tempted to lie, told him the truth.
No, he wasn't sorry. In fact, I had the distinct impression he was still rather proud of it.
Yakov nodded grimly, as if this fact seemed to confirm his rather pessimistic view of mankind. On Shabbat, Dina lit a pair of candles and recited the blessing. That night, instead of wandering Gabriel's dark past, they spoke of their dreams. Yaakov wanted only to sit in a Tel Aviv cafe without fear of the Shahid. Yossi wanted to trek the Arab world from Morocco to Baghdad and chronicle his experiences. Ramona longed to turn on the radio in the morning and hear that no one had been killed the night before. And Dina? Gabriel suspected that Dina's dreams, like his own, were a private screening room of blood and fire. After dinner, Gabriel slipped from the room and wandered off down the corridor. He came to a flight of stairs, climbed them, then became disoriented and was pointed in the right direction by a night janitor. The entrance was under guard. Gabriel tried to show his new ID badge, but the security officer just laughed and opened the door to him. The room was dimly lit, and, because of the computers, unbearably cold. The duty officers wore fleece pullovers and moved with the quiet efficiency of night staff in an intensive care ward. Gabriel climbed up to the viewing platform and leaned his weight against the aluminum handrail. Arrayed before him was a massive computer-generated map of the world, 10 feet in height, 30 in width. Scattered across the globe were pinpricks of light, each depicting the last known location of a terrorist on Israel's watch list. There were clusters in Damascus and Baghdad, and even in supposedly friendly places like Amman and Cairo. A river of light flowed from Beirut to the Beqa Valley to the refugee camps along Israel's northern border. The West Bank and Gaza were ablaze. A string of lights lay across Europe like a diamond necklace. The cities of North America glowed seductively. Gabriel felt a sudden weight of depression pushing down against his shoulders. He had given his life to the protection of the state and the Jewish people, and yet here, in this frigid room, he was confronted with the stark reality of the Zionist dream. A middle-aged man gazing upon a constellation of enemies, waiting for the next one to explode. Dina was waiting for him in the corridor in her stocking feet.
It feels familiar to me, Gabriel.
What's that?
The way they carried it off. The way they moved. The planning. The sheer audacity of the thing. It feels like Munich and Sabina.
She paused and pushed a loose strand of dark hair behind her ear.
It feels like Black September.
There is no Black September, Dina. Not anymore, at least.
You asked us to look for the thing that's missing. Does that include Khaled?
Khaled is a rumor. Khaled is a ghost story.
I believe in Khaled, she said. Khaled keeps me awake at night.
You have a hunch?
A theory, she said, and some interesting evidence to support it. Would you like to hear it?
Chapter 6, Tel Aviv, March 20th. They reconvened at 10 that evening. The mood, Gabriel would recall later, was that of a university study group, too exhausted for serious enterprise but too anxious to part company. Dina, in order to add credence to her hypothesis, stood behind a small tabletop lectern. Yossi sat cross-legged on the floor, surrounded by his precious files from research. Ramona, the only one in uniform, propped her sandaled feet on the back of Yossi's empty chair. Yaakov sat next to Gabriel, his body still as granite. Dina switched off the lights and placed a photograph on the overhead projector. It showed a child, a young boy, with a beret on his head and a kafia draped over his shoulders. The boy was seated on the lap of a distraught older man, Yasser Arafat.
This is the last confirmed photograph of Khaled al-Khalifa, Dina said. The setting is Beirut. The year is 1979. The occasion is the funeral of his father, Sabri al-Khalifa. Within days of the funeral, Khaled vanished. He has never been seen again.
Yakov stirred in the darkness.
I thought we were going to deal with reality, he grumbled.
Let her finish, snapped Ramona.
Yakov appealed his case to Gabriel, but Gabriel's gaze was locked on the accusatory eyes of the child.
Let her finish, he murmured.
Dina removed the photograph of the child and dropped a new one in its place. Black and white and slightly out of focus, it showed a man on horseback with bandoliers across his chest. A pair of dark, defiant eyes, barely visible through the small opening in his kafia, stared directly into the camera lens.
To understand Khaled, Dina said, one must first know his celebrated lineage. This man is Asad al-Khalifa, Khaled's grandfather, and the story begins with him.
Turkish-ruled Palestine, October 1910. He was born in the village of Beit Said to a desperately poor fella who had been cursed with 7 daughters. He named his only son Asad, Lion. Doted on by his mother and sisters, cherished by his weak and aging father, Asad al-Khalifa was a lazy child who never learned to read or write and refused his father's demand to memorize the Quran. Occasionally, when he wanted a bit of spending money, he would walk up the rutted track that led to the Jewish settlement of Petah Tikva and work all day for a few piastres. The Jewish foreman was named Zev.
It's Hebrew for wolf, he told Asad.
Zev spoke Arabic with a strange accent and always asked Asad questions about life in Beit Said. Asad hated the Jews, as did everyone in Beit Said, but the work wasn't backbreaking, and he was happy to take Zev's money. Petah Tikva made an impression on the young Asad. How was it that the Zionists, newcomers to this land, had made so much progress when most of the Arabs were still living in squalor? After seeing the stone villas and clean streets of the Jewish settlement, Asad felt ashamed when he returned to Beit Said. He wanted to live well, but he knew he would never become a rich and powerful man working for the Jew named Wolf. He stopped going to Petah Tikva and devoted his time to thinking about a new career. One evening, while playing dice in the village coffee house, he heard an older man make a lewd remark about his sister. He walked over to the man's table and calmly asked if he had heard the remark correctly.
You did indeed, the man said, and what's more, the unfortunate girl has the face of a donkey.
With that, the coffee house erupted into laughter. Asad, without another word, walked back to his table and resumed his game of dice. The next morning, the man who had insulted his sister was found in a nearby orchard with his throat slit and a shoe stuffed into his mouth, the ultimate Arab insult. A week later, when the man's brother publicly vowed to avenge the death, he, too, was found in the orchard in the same state. After that, no one dared insult young Asad. The incident in the coffee house helped Asad find his calling. He used his newfound notoriety to recruit an army of bandits. He chose only men from his tribe and clan, knowing that they would never betray him. He wanted the ability to strike far from Beit Said, so he stole a stable full of horses from the new rulers of Palestine, the British Army. He wanted the ability to intimidate rivals, so he stole guns from the British as well. When his raids began, they were like nothing Palestine had seen for generations. He and his band struck towns and villages from the coastal plain to the Galilee to the hills of Samaria and then vanished without a trace. His victims were mostly other Arabs, but occasionally he would raid a poorly defended Jewish settlement, and sometimes, if he was in the mood for Jewish blood, he would kidnap a Zionist and kill him with his long, curved knife. Asad al-Khalifa soon became a wealthy man. Unlike other successful Arab criminals, he did not draw attention to himself by flaunting his newfound riches. He wore the galabia and kafia of an ordinary fella and spent most nights in his family's mud and straw hut. To ensure his protection, He spread money and loot among his clan. To the world outside Beit Said, he appeared to be just an ordinary peasant, but inside the village, he was now called Sheikh Assad. He would not remain a mere bandit and highwayman for long. Palestine was changing, and from the vantage point of the Arabs, not for the better. By the mid-1930s, the Yishuv, the Jewish population of Palestine, had reached nearly a half million, compared with approximately a million Arabs. The official emigration rate was 60,000 per year, but Sheikh Assad had heard the actual rate was far higher than that. Even a poor boy with no formal schooling could see that the Arabs would be a minority in their own country. Palestine was like a tinder-dry forest. A single spark might set it ablaze. The spark occurred on April 15, 1936, when a gang of Arabs shot three Jews on the road east of Tulkarm. Members of the Jewish Irgun Bet retaliated by killing two Arabs not far from Beit Said. Events spiraled rapidly out of control, culminating with an Arab rampage through the streets of Jaffa that left nine Jews dead. The Arab revolt had begun. There had been periods of unrest in Palestine, times when Arab frustration would boil over into rioting and killing, but never had there been anything like the coordinated violence and unrest that swept the land that spring and summer of 1936. Jews all across Palestine became targets of Arab rage. Shops were looted, orchards uprooted, homes and settlements burned. Jews were murdered on buses and in cafes, even inside their own homes. In Jerusalem, the Arab leaders convened and demanded an end to all Jewish immigration and the immediate installation of an Arab-majority government. Sheikh Assad, though a thief, considered himself first and foremost a Shabab, a young nationalist, and he saw the Arab revolt as a chance to destroy the Jews once and for all. He immediately ceased all his criminal activities and transformed his gang of bandits into a jihadiyya, a secret holy war fighting cell. He then unleashed a series of deadly attacks against Jewish and British targets in the Lydda district of central Palestine, using the same tactics of stealth and surprise he'd employed as a thief. He attacked the Jewish settlement of Petah Tikva, where he'd worked as a boy, and killed Zev, his old boss, with a gunshot to the head. He also targeted the men he viewed as the worst traitors to the Arab cause, the Effendis, who had sold large tracts of land to the Zionists. Three such men he killed himself with his long, curved knife. Despite the secrecy surrounding his operations, the name Assad al-Khalifa was soon known to the men of the Arab Higher Council in Jerusalem. Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti and Chairman of the Council, wanted to meet this cunning Arab warrior who had shed so much Jewish blood in the Lydda district. Sheikh Assad traveled to Jerusalem disguised as a woman and met the red-bearded Mufti in an apartment in the old city, not far from the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
"You are a great warrior, Sheikh Assad. Allah has given you great courage, the courage of a lion."
"I fight to serve God," Sheikh Assad said, then quickly added, "and you, of course, Haj Amin."
Haj Amin smiled and stroked his neat red beard.
"The Jews are united. That is their strength. We Arabs have never known unity, family, clan, tribe. That is the Arab way. Many of our warlords, like you, Sheikh Assad, are former criminals, and I'm afraid many of them are using the revolt as a means of enriching themselves. They are raiding Arab villages and extorting tribute from the elders."
Sheikh Assad nodded. He had heard of such things. To ensure that he maintained the loyalty of the Arabs in the Lydda district, he had forbidden his men to steal. He'd gone so far as to lop off the hand of one of his own men for the crime of taking a chicken.
"I fear that as the revolt wears on," Haj Amin continued, our old divisions will begin to tear us apart. If our warlords act on their own, they will be mere arrows against the stone wall of the British army and the Jewish Haganah. But together,
Hajamin joined his hands, we can knock down their walls and liberate this sacred land from the infidels.
What is it you want me to do, Hajamin?
The Grand Mufti supplied Sheikh Assad with a list of targets in the Lida district, and the Sheikh's men attacked them with ruthless efficiency. Jewish settlements, bridges and power lines, police outposts. Sheikh Assad soon became Haj Amin's favorite warlord, and just as the Grand Mufti had predicted, other warlords grew envious of the accolades being heaped on the man from Beit Said. One of them, a brigand from Nablus, called Abu Farid, decided to lay a trap. He dispatched an emissary to meet with a Jew from the Haganah. The emissary told the Jew that Sheikh Assad and his men would attack the Zionist settlement of Hadera in 3 nights' time. As Sheikh Assad and his men approached Hadera that night, they were ambushed by Haganah and British forces and torn to pieces in a murderous crossfire. Sheikh Assad, badly wounded, managed to make his way on horseback across the border into Syria. He recuperated in a village on the Golan Heights and pieced together what had gone wrong at Hadera. Obviously, he had been betrayed by someone within the Arab camp, someone who had known when and where he was going to strike. He had two choices, to remain in Syria or return to the battlefield. He had no men and no weapons, and someone close to Haj Amin wanted him dead. Returning to Palestine to fight on was the courageous thing to do, but hardly the wise course of action. He remained in the Golan for a week longer. Then he went to Damascus. The Arab revolt was soon in tatters, torn from within just as Haj Amin had predicted, by feuding and clan rivalries. By 1938, more Arabs were dying at the hands of the rebels than Jews, and by 1939, the situation had disintegrated into a tribal war for power and prestige among the warlords themselves. By May 1939, 3 years after it had begun, the Great Arab Revolt was over. Wanted by the British and Haganah, Sheikh Assad decided to remain in Damascus. He bought a large apartment in the city center and married the daughter of another Palestinian exile. She bore him a son, whom he named Sabri. She became barren after that and gave him no more children. He considered divorcing her or taking another wife, but by 1947 his thoughts were occupied by things other than women and children. Once again, Sheikh Assad was summoned by his old friend Haj Amin. He, too, was living in exile. During the Second World War, the Mufti had thrown in his lot with Adolf Hitler. From his lavish palace in Berlin, the Islamic religious leader had served as a valuable Nazi propaganda tool, exhorting the Arab masses to support Nazi Germany and calling for the destruction of the Jews. An acquaintance of Adolf Eichmann, the architect of the Holocaust, the Mufti had even planned to construct a gas chamber and crematoria in Palestine to exterminate the Jews there. As Berlin was falling, he boarded a Luftwaffe plane and flew to Switzerland. Refused entry, he went next to France. The French realized that he could be a valuable ally in the Middle East and granted him sanctuary, but by 1946, with pressure mounting to put the Mufti on trial for war crimes, he was permitted to escape to Cairo. By the summer of 1947, the Mufti was living in Eilach, a resort in the mountains of Lebanon, and it was there that he met his trusted warlord, Sheikh Assad.
"You've heard the news from America?"
Sheikh Assad nodded. The special session of the new world body called the United Nations had convened to take up the issue of the future of Palestine.
"Clearly," said the Mufti, "we are going to be made to suffer for the crimes of Hitler. Our strategy for dealing with the United Nations will be a complete boycott of the proceedings. But if they decide to award one square inch of Palestine to the Jews,
We must be prepared to fight, which is why I need you, Sheikh Assad.
Sheikh Assad asked Haj Amin the same question he'd put to him 11 years earlier in Jerusalem.
What do you want me to do?
Return to Palestine and prepare for the war that is surely coming. Raise your fighting force. Draw up your battle plans. My cousin, Abdel Kader, will be responsible for the Ramallah area and the hills east of Jerusalem. You will be in command of the central district, the coastal plain, Tel Aviv and Jaffa, and the Jerusalem corridor.
I'll do it, Sheikh Assad said. Then he quickly added, on one condition.
The Grand Mufti was taken aback. He knew that Sheikh Assad was a fierce and proud man, but no Arab ever dared to speak to him like that, especially a former fellah. Still, he smiled and asked the warlord to name his price.
Tell me the name of the man who betrayed me in Hadera.
Haj Amin hesitated, then answered truthfully. Sheikh Assad was more valuable to his cause than Abu Farid.
Where is he?
That night, Sheikh Assad traveled to Beirut and slit the throat of Abu Farid. Then he returned to Damascus to bid farewell to his wife and son and see to their financial needs. A week later, he was back in his old straw-and-mud cottage in Beit Said. He spent the remaining months of 1947 raising his force and planning his strategy for the coming conflict. Frontal assaults against heavily defended Jewish population centers would prove futile, he concluded. Instead, he would strike the Jews where they were most vulnerable. Jewish settlements were scattered around Palestine and dependent on the roads for supplies. In many cases, such as the vital Jerusalem corridor, those roads were dominated by Arab towns and villages. Sheikh Assad immediately understood the opportunity before him. He could strike soft targets with complete tactical surprise. Then, when the engagement was over, his forces could melt into the sanctuaries of the villages. The settlements would slowly wither, and so, too, would the Jewish will to remain in Palestine. On November 29th, the United Nations declared that British rule in Palestine would soon end. There were to be two states in Palestine, one Arab, the other Jewish. For the Jews, it was a night of celebration. The 2,000-year-old dream of a state in the ancient home of the Jews had come true. For the Arabs, it was a night of bitter tears. Half of their ancestral home was to be given to the Jews. Sheikh Assad al-Khalifa spent that night planning his first strike. The following morning, his men attacked a bus as it made its way from Netanya to Jerusalem, killing 5 people. The battle for Palestine had begun. Throughout the winter of 1948, Sheikh Assad and the other Arab commanders turned the roads of central Palestine into a Jewish graveyard. Buses, taxis, and supply trucks were attacked, drivers and passengers massacred without mercy. As winter turned to spring, Haganah losses in men and materiel mounted at an alarming rate. During a 2-week span in late March, Arab forces killed hundreds of the Haganah's best fighters and destroyed the bulk of its fleet of armored vehicles. By the end of the month, the settlements of the Negev were cut off. More important, so too were the 100,000 Jews of West Jerusalem. For the Jews, the situation was growing desperate. The Arabs had seized the initiative, and Sheikh Assad was almost single-handedly winning the war for Palestine. On the night of March 31, 1948, David Ben-Gurion, leader of the Yeshuv, met in Tel Aviv with senior officers of the Haganah and the elite Palmach strike force and ordered them to go on the offensive. The days of trying to protect vulnerable convoys against overwhelming odds were over, Ben-Gurion said. The entire Zionist enterprise faced imminent collapse unless the Battle of the Roads was won and the interior of the country secured. In order to achieve that goal, the conflict had to be taken to a new level of violence. The Arab villages that Sheikh Assad and the other warlords used as bases for their operations had to be conquered and destroyed. And if there was no other option, the inhabitants had to be expelled. The Haganah had already drawn up a master plan for just such an operation. It was called Tochnit Dalet, Plan D. Ben-Gurion ordered it to begin in 2 days with Operation Nachshon, an assault on the villages lining the besieged Jerusalem corridor.
"And one more thing," he said to his commanders as the meeting adjourned. "Find Sheikh Assad as quickly as possible and kill him."
The man chosen to hunt down Sheikh Assad, a young Palmach intelligence officer named Ari Shamran, knew that Sheikh Assad would not be easy to find. The warlord maintained no fixed military headquarters and was rumored to sleep in a different house each night. Shamran, though he had immigrated to Palestine from Poland in 1935, knew the Arab mind well. He knew that, to the Arabs, some things were more important than an independent Palestine. Somewhere during his rise to power, Sheikh Assad had surely made an enemy, and somewhere in Palestine was an Arab thirsting for revenge. It took 10 days to find him, a man from Beit Said who, many years earlier, had lost 2 of his brothers to Sheikh Assad over an insult in the village coffee house. Shamran offered the Arab 100 Palestinian pounds if he would betray the whereabouts of the warlord. A week later, on a hillside near Beit Said, they met for a second time. The Arab told Shamran where their common enemy could be found.
"I hear he's planning to spend the night in a cottage outside Lida. It's in the middle of an orange grove. Assad, the murderous dog, is surrounded by bodyguards. They're hiding in the orchards. If you try to attack the cottage with a large force, the guards will sound the alert and Assad will flee like the coward that he is."
"And what do you recommend?" Shamran asked, playing to the Arab's vanity.
"A single assassin, a man who can slip through the defenses and kill Assad before he can escape. For another 100 pounds, I'll be that man."
Shamran did not wish to insult his informant, so he spent a moment pretending to consider the offer, even though his mind was already made up. The assassination of Sheikh Assad was too important to be trusted to a man who would betray his own people for money. He hurried back to Palmach headquarters in Tel Aviv and broke the news to the deputy commander, a handsome man with red hair and blue eyes named Yitzhak Rabin.
"Someone needs to go to Lida alone tonight and kill him," Shamran said.
"Chances are whoever we select won't come out of that house alive."
"I know," Shamran said. "That's why it has to be me."
"You're too important to risk on a mission like this."
"If this goes on much longer, we'll lose Jerusalem, and then we'll lose the war. What's more important than that?"
Rabin could see that there was no talking him out of it.
"What can I do to help you?"
"Make certain there's a car and driver waiting for me on the edge of that orange grove after I kill him."
At midnight, Shamran climbed on a motorbike and rode from Tel Aviv to Lida. He left the bike a mile from town and walked the rest of the way to the edge of the orchard. Such assaults, Shamran had learned from experience, were best carried out shortly before dawn, when the sentries were fatigued and at their least attentive. He entered the orchard a few minutes before sunrise, armed with a Sten gun and a steel trench knife. In the first gray light of the day, he could make out the faint shadows of the guards propped against the trunks of the orange trees. One slept soundly as Shamran crept past. A single guard stood watch in the dusty forecourt of the cottage. Shamran killed him with a silent thrust of his knife. Then he entered the cottage. It had but one room. Sheikh Assad lay sleeping on the floor. 2 of his senior lieutenants were seated cross-legged next to him, drinking coffee. Caught off guard by Shamran's silent approach, they did not react to the opening of the door. Only when they looked up and saw an armed Jew did they attempt to reach for their weapons. Shamran killed them both with a single burst of his Sten gun. Sheikh Assad awakened with a start and reached for his rifle. Shamron fired. Sheikh Assad, as he was dying, gazed into his killer's eyes.
"Another will take my place," he said.
"I know," replied Shamron. Then he fired again. He slipped from the cottage as the sentries came running. In the half-light of dawn, he picked his way through the trees until he came to the edge of the orange grove. The car was waiting. Yitzhak Rabin was behind the wheel. "Is he dead?" Rabin asked as he accelerated away. Shamron nodded. "It's done." "Good," said Rabin. "Let the dogs lap up his blood."